that makes me know that we had the right idea in the beginning, and we just need to maintain our focus and elevate. We update our formulas. We have certain formulas, but we update them with the times and everything, you know, and so.
Hello, my basketball friends, and welcome to the Teardrop Runners, the show where four old friends try to teach themselves and each other a little something about basketball analytics. I'm your host, Slash Walnut, Scott in Baltimore, and with us, as always, are...
Manziel Blakely, in a very uncomfortable position.
Chris Ballamore Brown.
And Big Shot Rob, hitting you out from Manhattan. What's up, guys?
What's up, guys? I'll tell you what's up. Have you ever seen the movie Stuck on You featuring Matt Damon and Greg Kinnear as conjoined twins?
No.
I don't believe I have.
No. You're familiar with it, I'm sure. Yeah. It's a Fairly Brothers classic.
Is this like a remake of Step Brothers, maybe?
No. I mean, I don't even know why you would say that. It wouldn't make sense. Why would Step Brothers have been remade? Step Brothers came out like 2 years ago.
11, 2012.
Anyway. Features. The point is, hey, Manziel, can I make my point? Can I just make my original point? I mean, I brought up Stuck on You for a reason. I wasn't just like, hey, let's have movie chat. The reason I bring up Stuck on You is because I just want to alert you guys to the fact that Chris and I are conjoined by a headphone cable. We are currently recording in the same location in Baltimore. And so if you hear a knocking sound, it sounds like a coconut fell on top of another coconut. Please call 911. All right, guys, we start every week with our scouting homework, those of us who enjoy watching the NBA. This week I was scouting Kemba Walker. Now, Kemba Walker was widely regarded as a disappointment last season. Obviously, the Bobcats were the worst team ever, if you go by winning percentage. Chris, you noticed that Kemba Walker's plus-minus was pretty abysmal in his rookie season as well. Is that right?
He was the worst player by plus-minus on the Bobcats last year, which I believe was one of the worst teams, if not the worst team, in the history of the league. So, yeah, he was a bad, bad, bad player.
So you're taking the last
round. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'm happy to report that his plus-minus is significantly better this season. His plus-minus in the 2011-2012 season was plus 0.8. And let me pull it up here. His plus-minus in the 2012-2013 season is something like 7.5. Is that right?
7.4, yes.
I think 7.4, excuse me. So, I mean, obviously he's making a lot of progress. And when I watched him this week, I watched a few games against the Lakers. He was spectacular in that game, breaking them down on the perimeter. I watched him against Chicago. He was good. He was unfortunately kind of embarrassed by Deron Williams against Brooklyn and Chris will be able to enlighten us on that a little bit. But, you know, in general, I'd say he's a significantly improved player from last year. Obviously, playing with him, KG helps, but his crossover is much better. He's more aggressive with it. Chris, have you had a chance to watch Charlotte Bobcats on the break?
I've had a little bit of a chance. I mean, I think my thought with Kemba is that having MKG, you know, playing with him too, really helps a lot. With his game in transition, basically having better players surrounding him may be contributing to his big improvement this year.
And I love the way he runs in transition. Manziel, what were you going to say?
I mean, I suspect that he wasn't the worst guy on the Bobcats last year, but it's plus minus.
I would definitely agree with that. He was not the worst player on the Bobcats. The 340-pound Andre the Giant impression that was Boris Diaw was the worst player on the Bobcats. Although arguably it was appearing.
You know, on the other hand, a great philosopher once said, ball stats don't lie.
I do remember that philosopher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, ball stats don't lie.
Schiedenstein. Was that Schiedenstein?
Schiedenstein okay. Came up with that.
Obviously, you know, Kemba Walker is also an interesting case in the value of steals. He had 61 last season. He already has 60 this season. But in general, I think his offense is still pretty miserable. Menzel, what were you going to say?
61 steals in 66 games from a guy who plays a good number of minutes in your team.
I agree with you. That was my point. He didn't have very many steals last season. He already has 60 this season. Do you think that's any value, any showing of improvement? Because to me, I don't see his overall defense as being all that much better. I see his defense problem being the same problem that a lot of Charlotte defenders have, which is that they're a little raw. They tend to jump out a little too much. They're a little too eager with their ball pressure, and it's a problem. So I don't know. What do you guys think about that? You think that his increased steals means an increase in his in the value on defense?
So, you know, I mean, I do have a thought in this area, not on that question. Actually, steals to me are not, you know, I don't care much about them. But one,
not interested in steals, not a fantasy maven.
Yeah, that's right. One thing that does stand out is his rather low effective field goal percentage. That's this year, supposedly. This, you know, while last year was his terrible, terrible plus-minus year, this year things have really turned around for him. His plus-minus is much better. However, his effective field goal percentage offensively still is not that great. So he's hitting 46.7% EFG.
And can you remind us what EFG is?
So that's basically a two-point shot plus 1.5 times 3-point times 2 for a 3-point shot plus 0.44 times free throws attempted divided by the total number of field goals.
All right, thank you, Chris. I would like to apologize to the listener. I did not realize the explanation was that complicated, but it's amazing that you were able to rattle that off. Thank
we'll
you.
See, yeah,
in any case,
no, he has a tattoo on the back of his hand.
That is how we do it on the teardrop runners. We have certain formulas. In any case, I see that, you know, I see him missing a lot of his mid-range shots, but I still see him working on developing, getting contact and drawing fouls. He was in the top 20 last season in free throw attempts, and I think he's headed that way this season as well, although he's not in that group right now. So overall, the Charlotte Bobcats can be a little bit frustrating to watch. But, you know, the way he plays the game with MKG next to him is definitely worth watching. And when they play a good game, it's a thrill to watch. So, go ahead, Menzel.
Yeah, just to finish up on the steals real quick before we move forward. I do think that steals in general are a sign of gambling, especially from guards, which I don't like. But being that he is a really young player, is he 20 this year?
I believe that's right.
That, you know, his steal rate's gone up by 50%. My suspicion that just means he's gambling better. He's probably not sacrificing all that much in terms of keeping in front of his guy. He's being, taking better gambles, I guess. My suspicion.
I appreciate that suspicion, Doctor. I have watched a fair amount of Bobcats game this year, and Bobcats game this year, is that the correct way to construct that clause?
Sounds pretty good, yeah.
Okay, so I've watched a lot of them, and they also do a lot of kind of ball traps in the corners and up on the wing, and he gets a lot of steals that way as well. So a lot of those are team steals. I haven't looked at the team steal numbers.
So question for you guys, who's Kemba's backup?
Well, that would be a couple guys, but Gerald Henderson and Ramon Sessions. Gerald Henderson and Ramon Sessions.
So, just the thought is that, you know, I don't trust his plus-minus being so terrible last year and so good this year. I know earlier I said ball stats don't lie, but, you know, I think the backups on this team are sucking hard. That's my theory, is that the plus-minus numbers are somewhat questionable and, you know, what's going on with the backups.
Yeah.
So, Chris, what you're saying is the stats are lying.
The ball stats did lie. I'm just kidding. But let me say this. You know, remember, this is still a bad team. So, you know, the fact that his plus-minus numbers maybe don't bear out that he's having a great season, that's fine. I mean, to me, I'm just looking for progress, and I definitely see it.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I didn't see a great game from him when he was playing the guy you were scouting this week, Deron Williams.
Yes.
How did you enjoy scouting the man that you once dubbed a natural fatty or a natty fatty.
Yeah. So just to give you guys some perspective on this player, he was the centerpiece of Brooklyn's rebuild. just got signed to a contract, a 5-year, $100 million contract in the offseason. And was a guy that for many years has been looked at as kind of a franchise cornerstone type player, a guy that deserved a max contract, and a guy that maybe a team could build around over the long run. Anyways, the thing that was interesting about this to me is that Deron Williams, by plus minus this year, is actually one of the players that's hurting Brooklyn. So Brooklyn's had a, you know, big jump in terms of wins and losses compared to last season, but actually it wasn't driven by the guy that just got signed to the big contract. It's actually some of the more role player type guys on the team.
How big was that contract, Chris?
A 5-year, $100 million.
Is that on your other hand?
That's awfully big.
Yeah.
Was that a fatty contract?
The theory, I was wondering about why this change happened. And, you know, of course, you know, I think I was actually might have been watching the game with one of you guys, but I just remarked that I don't think Deron Williams is getting as much, you know, lift as he used to get. And he's looking, frankly, a little heavy and a little sweaty. And I mean, you know, I'm not a guy that has a problem with a sweaty an athlete, you know, I myself was one.
Notoriously, one of the drippiest athletes in the world.
It's true.
I think that being sweaty is a known positive thing in the basketball court. It makes it harder to D you up.
Yeah, maybe, but I'm just saying,
look at the way that Kobe drips.
What if you're a big fat? So here's another theory. Let's back off. So the thing was, though,
Deron
Williams looks like he's bigger than he used to look. And so, anyways, this is the theory, is that, okay, Deron Williams is beginning to kind of suck, and maybe he's gained weight. So I went into the numbers and looked at the plus-minus that he had basically since he entered the league. And surprisingly, his plus-minus was neither strongly positive nor strongly negative.
Well, what about that fancy EFGA that you were talking about earlier?
Yeah. So there's some reasons why plus minus may not work with Deron Williams, and I don't want to talk about it too much now. But
good.
The thing that you do see is a strong trend with his effective field goal average. So it starts out when he's a first and second year player in the league. It's 47.7, 51.3, 53.9. This is his best year offensively in the league, is 2007. Then 50.6, so trending down, 51.5, still going down, 51.14, actually holding steady there. Then basically the next year, 46.7, so that's the lowest in his career. Then this year, 46.3. So, you know, what we're seeing, so how's that effective field goal average number so low?
Chris, let me ask you a question before you get into that. Can you told us the formula earlier. We were also dazzled. I forgot to ask the follow-up question. Why is that a valuable statistic? Like, what is that meant to measure?
It measures efficiency, really.
And how does it do that?
So by adding points for guys that draw foul shots or that take and hit outside shots from 3-point range at a higher percentage.
Okay.
So it's basically a very this number, effective field goal average, plus the number of shot attempts that a player has, largely determines, you know, their impact on the offensive end of the field.
Okay. So go ahead. I'm sorry. So as you watch these effective field goal averages decline, what is your next step?
So the next step is, why is the EFGA going down in his case? And then we can look at his jump shot percentage, which is a basically it's the number of shots that a player is taken, I think, outside 4 or 5 feet from the rim. And what we see in Deron Williams' case is that this number actually increases every year that I have statistics for it. So in 2008, he was a 66% jump shooting guard. You know, that number I gave is 2008. 2009, 69%. 2010, you know, 75%, 74%, 2011, 80%, 2012, 81%. And so, you know, what we can see with, well, we don't know this for a fact, but the correlations here with Darren Williams is that his effective field goal percentage is slowly eroding and his jump shot percentage is slowly increasing. Now, the third element that I'm trying to find out and don't have yet is how much he weighed every year.
Mm. We need to determine how much of a natty fatty this man actually is.
That's right. That is the next step in the analysis.
It's I have started in on this, looking at YouTube highlights and, like, Googling a lot, but no big hits so far. But he definitely, from Google Images, has gained weight since college.
You heard it from Google Images first.
Well,
go ahead, step in.
I'm not so sure that gaining weight since college is...
Wasn't exactly a little skinny guy in college.
He's not the only one.
For a lot of guys, that probably is true. But for a point guard in the NBA, it might help.
Now, we got to reiterate that this is all in good fun, and we have nothing but the utmost respect for Darren Williams and anyone in his entourage, friends, or family who might be listening to this extremely popular podcast. Well, that's really interesting work. I'm sure, I guess let me ask you this. If Mikhail Prokhorov called you tomorrow, which is always a possibility, you are a high-profile individual.
Number 8 on speed dial.
And he says to you, what am I going to do with this man?
I would say put him on a treadmill.
Put him on a treadmill, all right.
Okay.
So the answer is that, I mean...
What about trading him?
Yeah, what about that?
They can't trade him right now. They're fucked. I mean,
they actually can't trade him. Super fucked. Can they under the CBA? Can they trade him right now?
I have no idea.
They might need a wait.
That's something we should all know. But it's interesting work. Any other thoughts on Darren Williams?
I find it interesting that Chris Brown's more interested in his weight over the years, and that stat is important. But the stat of Kemba Walker's plus minus this year. But Kemba Walker's plus minus this year is pretty much irrelevant because the people behind him suck.
Yeah, so speaking of the people behind you, though, Darren Williams does play on a team full of a lot of guys who I think are probably basically overhyped. Joe Johnson, I think, is...
I don't think anyone thinks Joe Johnson's a superstar.
Yeah, I mean,
maybe a ghetto superstar.
Oh, dude.
I understand.
Come to Brooklyn.
You know what you got. I understand that. I'm talking about the general population. I mean, I thought Michael Cage was a superstar when I was a kid. So...
The other thing is I agree with you, Manziel, that you're right, that Joe Johnson is not actually a superstar. Having said that, ball stats don't lie, and he's plus 19 on the season.
Well, we should clarify, ball stats don't lie unless Chris disagrees with them.
So anyways, going back to your point about Joe Johnson, is like this cannot possibly be correct, this particular ball stat, but it's plus 19. It's saying he's plus 19. Like, that's like classic LeBron James territory right there.
That's what you call a high plus minus.
Do we know if the Nets as a team are good or bad?
They're good
right now.
I mean, they're not great, but they're good.
I mean, they already fired their coach. PJ Kalissimo is running the show.
I mean, they got it, like I was saying, they have a Darren Williams problem. So by that, you know, if a coach runs into conflict with a star player on the team, especially if it's a star player that just signed a 5-year, $100 million contract, then it doesn't matter what the coach did or didn't do, that coach has got to get fired because you can't fire a $100 million player.
This is the kind of pragmatic advice that Mikhail Prokhorov loves, needs, and wants.
Yeah.
And I think we need to put you guys in touch. All right, well, I'm sure a lot of Nets fans that are listening to our super successful and popular podcast are going to be upset to hear that they have a Darren Williams problem, but that's Chris's analysis. Rob, you also had homework this week. You picked a team, and we picked a player for you. You were looking at Taj Gibson, the son of the old Pac-10.
Yeah.
All right, you played in the Pac-10, right?
Yeah, USC.
All
USC
right.
Grad. I watched a couple of games of Taj Gibson, and I kind of wonder, I know Tibby's a good coach, but he's not really getting many minutes right now unless, you know, someone's hurt. Like, every now and then Noah's sat out, actually. He's getting just about 20 minutes a game. One of the games I watched, he was out here, he was playing the Knicks. That was the one where all the crap went crazy at the end. Everyone got ejected, and even though Knicks scored almost 50 points in the fourth quarter, they still lost. He played 4 minutes in that game. He's averaging 7-5 right now. Per 36, he'd be 13-9. So, you know, he's very serviceable. He's a good guy coming off the bench, playing at the four. I unfortunately did not see, they played the Magic, two weeks ago, and Noah was out, and they started him at center, and he had just like a hell of a game. And I was, trolling some, Bulls blogs, or I guess not trolling, I still don't really know what that means. I wasn't saying anything mean. I was surfing the World Wide Web, per se. And,
you're right.
And they are all big Taj Gibson supporters. They, you know, they said he had some really good post moves. I've seen some very good moves, you know, not too many, because he's not really getting enough time, in my opinion. But, yeah, so it's kind of interesting to see. Tibbs is, you know, he's kind of refusing. He likes to go small. He'll put Dang out there at the four. And every now and then he'll throw in, this Butler kid, from Marquette. And it's pretty much the only three guys coming off the bench here, him, Butler, and Nate Robb. It's still, you would think with Ashik leaving that his minutes would go up, but they've actually slightly gone down this season, despite the fact that I don't think he's gotten worse.
So who's he behind?
He's behind Boozer. Boozer, no, he'll come in, he'll play for Noah sometimes at the center spot. He'll play at the five or the four. But he's behind Boozer, Noah, and then, you know, they'll move Dang over, like I said, from three to four.
Do you think that they should start Gibson over Boozer?
Oh, man. Chicago would love that, too.
I think they would.
Well, do you know what their plus
minus is? I think with Rose out, I think plus minus. That's tough. I think with Rose out now, I think Boozer's a little better of a scoring option right now.
It'd be
tough for them. You know, they're still playing great defense, and that's what's keeping them above 500 and sitting pretty, which I'm pretty excited to see Rose come back soon, hopefully, knock on wood.
So, Scott, do you have any – Scott basically just pulled up the plus-minus page. I'm going to let him
– I'm not going to brag you guys, but what I did was I typed in A2Games.com. I selected the Chicago Bulls, and what I found was that Boozer's plus-minus is minus 11.2, and Gibson's at a plus 6.3. So that's certainly an argument for starting him, although we all know plus-minus is not in any way a catch-all stat.
Yeah.
That's cause for concern, though, right, Chris? If you're a Bulls fan, don't you want to see Gibson out there more?
Yes.
Yeah, you know, he's 27. His minutes per game, 27 years old this season. His minutes per game has basically hovered right around 20. So, you know, I think this is the time in his career kind of where he needs to be expanding a little bit, and also the time in Boozer's career where he needs
to be. Tell me what you mean by contracting his game.
So, yes, I would play. I would want to see Gibson playing closer to 30 minutes a game.
All right. I think there's probably a lot of Bulls fan that Bulls fans that would agree with you based on what Rob's told us.
So,
yeah. One thing I'm noticing really quickly about Gibson, this might be unprecedented. He looks like a career 64% free throw shooter entering this year, and he's shooting 80% this year.
Hey,
and wow, his free throw attempts have not dipped. 32 games compared to, you know, half as many games as last year. A very clear record of being a middling 60% free throw shooter and shooting 80%.
That's could be luck, encouraging.
But I mean. It almost seems rare to see a guy in the NBA have a distinct.
Hasn't Noah improved a little bit too? But go ahead, Chris. Sorry.
I just had a quick question for Rob, real quick. So kind of the Taj Gibson hallmark over his career is being like tough defense. You know, long rangey guy, really good on just killing pick and rolls because he could switch. So he was a big man that could switch easily. But you know, his offense has always been shaky. Do you see him developing much as an offensive player, or is this just not a part of the game that
he'll ever get? I'm doing this based off of some of the reading and research and homework I did, and also based off of what I saw. You know, I don't think he'll ever be the scorer, you know, that Boozer maybe is, but I do think he can get up there. He's got some good post moves. He's got such long arms. He can turn and do that little hook shot, and it's pretty near impossible to block. He's also an athletic freak. I don't know if you guys seen this guy dunk, but when he and DeRozan would do shit at USC, it was pretty nuts. So, yeah, I do.
He can dunk the ball.
He can dunk the ball very well. But yeah, he's definitely much more of an asset on defense. I conked out as soon as you were about to say it's plus minus. I saw Boozer was minus 11. What was he in? He was a plus.
It's good. He was at plus six three.
Okay, cool.
Enzo.
Boozer did put I put 21 points on the Magic, and they have a real center on that team. And then 18 points.
Yeah, the Magic's when he played like 40-something minutes. That was like the best game he played all year because Noah was out. Yeah.
So, I mean, his offense isn't inept, but...
No, his offense isn't inept. It's his defense that's inept, right? I mean, he's essentially a liability out there.
Boozer. Boozer.
Boozer.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we'll see how it goes. I haven't seen him. I haven't watched him closely this year, so I don't know how he's looking on offense. But that'll always be the big question mark for him. It's just, how much can he contribute?
All right, quick fire for all three of you. Scott, you're first. Defensively, who would you rather have? Carlos Boozer or Jimmer Fredette?
Defensively?
Fredette? Probably Jimmer.
What?
I would say Boozer.
You're not saying that the same
thing. No. Right? I picked the two worst defensive players I could think of. Hey, man.
Oh, man. That's a tough one. I don't know. But so overall, you feel like that, if you're a Bulls fan looking forward, Gibson's one of the guys.
Yeah. Maybe they could take some pressure off Noah. Noah's getting 40-plus minutes a game. Maybe sit him down a few more minutes, give Taj, try to unleash the inner Gibson. Whatever the frick that means, I apologize to my fans.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah. You guys, you're potty mouths.
Yeah. All right, well, that's excellent work, boys. Menzel, of course, did not do homework because he doesn't believe.
Just like high school.
That's why he's still in the fourth grade.
I think just like high school, yeah. Rob, you wanted to talk this week about... the home court advantage and whether or not that was a thing in the NBA and whether or not it mattered. Why don't you walk us through that?
Yeah, I was just doing my thing, at my day job, staring at the NBA standings, and I noticed that every team in the NBA, except for two, had a better record at home than they did away. And I was like, oh, okay, people would obviously play a little better at home. They must, But the only two that didn't were 3 and 4 wins, both home and away. I think it was the Wiz and probably Charlotte. But no more macro pests. So I think, I made a comment, and Manziel said that basketball had more home court advantage than football, and I thought it was crazy because us being Seattle fans and seeing the Seahawks go 8-0 this year at home, like, that's nuts, that's not possible. But I did indeed look it up, and as Chris Brownie Brown says and doesn't always stand by it, the stats don't lie. Basketball home court advantage for the last 11 years has been 60%. The home team has won, and in football it's been 58%, hockey 55%, and baseball 53%. This year it's at a staggering 61%, so a little above the average. With the Western Conference killing it at 68%, the Eastern Conference at 54%. Now, there are obviously two reasons, in my mind, for why the Western Conference is better. One, they're just better at all-around basketball, and two, I was listening to more Simmons podcast with David Lee and Steph Curry the other day, and they were naming the toughest places to play, and I think three of the four of them were in the Western Conference, and they would be, Manziel, can you name one of them?
I can name at least three of them. Scott, can you
name one would be good, please?
I'm going to go ahead with Denver, Utah, and Portland.
Okay, Jerk. Yes, you named all three of them.
Hey.
Thank you.
Bum, 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 bum.
Yep, those are three of the four that I listed. So I thought it was interesting, and I was wondering why don't people, when you hear analysts talk about games, and I understand with NBA playoffs it's a 7-game series instead of 1 game in football, but analysts go all ape shit, pardon my French to my fans, about being, home or away for the football game, and they rarely say much about, this basketball game is being played at the Garden, or this is being played at Oak City's high school arena that I hate. I hate them. Sorry, I'm not bitter. But, you know.
I don't know that I can agree that it's not talked about. I mean, I think when it's in one of those places, it's brought up pretty prominently. But I would agree that you don't hear it as quite as much of an issue as you do in football.
So, does anybody know how they decide who, which conference gets four of the seven games for the NBA Finals?
Yeah, hot dog eating contest.
It is best record.
The dunk contest, right?
Yes, Chris. It's
the best record. Just straight up.
Ding, 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 ding.
No goofball.
So I mean, just a quick thought on why, you know, home versus road, you know, may not be the same thing, is that I think the refs figure more prominently in professional basketball than the other sports. Basically, big calls, especially down the stretch, have a huge influence on the game. Even things like if the ref doesn't, you know, is even-handed with the way they call, they could have a style of call that would favor one team or another depending on what type of personnel a team is fielding. You know, we've seen big playoff series in the past swung by calls. You know, we've also lived in an area of the country, frankly, that is, you know, discriminated against, you know, by referees from everywhere.
Liberal use of the word discrimination, Chris, but we are from Seattle, and we have been the victim of some terrible moments, although I think a lot of Green Bay Packers fans would agree with that.
Regular season.
Another possible explanation for the home field advantage or home court advantage that I ran by Rob was the possibility that maybe while, you know, your kind of hardened veterans and your superstars can play anywhere, your bench guys are more comfortable and happier and more popular at home. Rob, did you look
at that? I did. I couldn't find any statistical support to your claim. I do believe it, though. If you think about it, especially with me when I play, if I'm playing in a gym that I've played in before or that I got a good warm-up, then I feel much better. But if you think about these guys that are coming in raw and they're only getting, you know, 5 minutes a game or maybe 15 minutes a game, they're taking fewer shots. And if they're in their own arena, they're probably more comfortable. Maybe I'll try to do some homework for next week and see if I can find any statistical evidence to back that up. Another thing we didn't talk about is, you know, the crowd can easily get into it. I know we got Karl Malone rattled before. And the crowd can also affect the refs. You know, if they're yelling at the refs all day, I think there's a couple of bad calls.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about, dude.
I know you were talking about the refs, but you didn't say that the crowds would get into the refs.
It's just another factor. It's like we're all friends who are basketball buddies, you guys. Remember, we're just four basketball buddies. All right, Rob.
Oh, no, that was pretty much it. I just thought it was an interesting fact. I think if you took a poll of an average sports fan, most of them would guess that a home court or field advantage would be more prominent in football. But the actual answer, as Manziel correctly guessed, is basketball.
Because basketball is the best sport. And Manziel?
Yeah, I just wanted to throw my little two cents. I think to me the interesting thing about the fact that basketball has the strongest home court advantage is that of the major three sports, I'll say, it's the only one where the rules of the game don't differentiate whatsoever in any way between the home and road team. You know, baseball, obviously the park effect is very strong.
How does that change the rules?
And
what about football?
In football.
Yeah, I think you might have stepped in it there with football, buddy.
Well, you know, in football, the home team gets to call the coin toss.
Oh, my God.
Oh, man. That's a great inspirational example of what we call digging deep, ladies and gentlemen.
It's more than nothing.
But one of the reasons why Manziel has to dig deep like that is because you know, he is a mad scientist. He has not been watching a lot of basketball lately. Every time he turns it on, he just sees a stream of ones and zeros on the screen because he's a data scientist. And so, Manziel, you've been in the lab, and that's what this next segment is called. We're on segment two, Back to the Lab. Manziel, what have you been working on in the lab?
I spent the entire holiday season constructing the mega lab.
You didn't even celebrate Christmas home, if I'm correct, right? You were one of the victims of the war
on
Christmas.
I was in the lab on Christmas. Yeah. No, what I did over the past month was was to construct a database. Database is one of my favorite things in the world, but this is a database of play-by-play data for every NBA game for the last 3.5 or so seasons. This is every shot, foul, substitution, rebound, everything you can think of that happens. Well, almost everything you can think of that happens in an NBA game.
And where did you get this data?
In a special database. So yeah, I downloaded it for free, for steal, off the internet. Basketballreference.com is the source I use, and just for all you people at home, scour the play-by-play data yourselves. You can get your play-by-play from ESPN, or from NBA.com, or from Basketball Reference, or from other sources. They're all a little bit different. If you read the NBA.com play-by-play data, you get some, like, tidbits where it'll say, Taj Gibson made running hook shot, and all this kind of flowery prose about what's going on. I like Basketball Reference because it's very cut and dry.
Yeah, and we should note that we don't have My Synergy because we're not insiders. We're outsiders. We're bringing it to you like it is. We're not hanging out with the athletes at the press conferences. We don't have My Synergy.
But we are. We're looking through the window and hoping to get invited.
Yeah, exactly. We're asking for another bowl of porridge. Go ahead, Manziel. Sorry.
Yeah. So, you know, basically what I can do with all this data is we could use this data to create all the kind of stats that we've been talking about and are familiar with. So, you know, field goal percentage, rebounds, or even the advanced stats, the plus minus stats even. And we can look at that over any amount of time. So I can look at a plus minus for a guy in a particular game, over a season, on a road trip, over multiple seasons, and so forth. So one of the things though that I worked on very hard though to make this a little more powerful is to connect all these events, so the shots and the steals, into possessions, which are a series of plays, so that I could look and say, oh, the 10th or 15th possession for this team, this game lasted 18 seconds. There was a foul, then there was free throws, then there was an offensive rebound on that, and they shot a three, and I, you know, all those things I could say happened in a series within a single possession. So if you've been paying attention, listeners,
we know you have been
very hard. I think you're transcribing. The possessions is kind of a big deal for all the advanced stats.
I mean, tell me how possessions became so important.
Well, so obviously any type of efficiency stat. So let's throw out a very, very, very low level efficiency stat, field goal percentage, right?
Yes.
That's makes per attempt. So obviously, you know, within smart NBA circles, people realize very quickly that just per attempt wasn't really good enough. You know,
and that's because the number of possessions varies so wildly from game to game, right?
How do we, Manny, just real quick, what is the definition of a possession?
Basically, a possession ends. This is the only real definition, is when it ends. It ends when you make a 2 or 3 point shot. It ends when the other team gets a defensive rebound. It also ends when you commit a turnover or at the end of a quarter. And then I think there's a couple other little edge cases for uncommon scenarios.
So possession is basically when the ball moves from the control of one team to another.
That's how we define the end of a possession, is a change in possession.
Yep.
Mm.
Okay. So it's you're looking at possessions, and where does that come into play? Where do possessions come into play in the basketball analytics world?
Okay, so probably the most popular stat right now, both for teams and players, that is both a high level stat and talked about a lot is offensive defensive ratings. So this is points per,
sometimes also called efficiency, right?
Yeah. Points per 100 possession. Right? So right there you see it, per possession. And this is to control for things like the pace of play. So I think for years under George Karl, people always said, oh, they give up 105 points a game or however many points a game, they're not playing any D. But of course, you know, the team was scoring more points per game than that. And just because of the style of play that they played, there was a lot of possessions, a lot of opportunities to score points. You know, conversely, so it was bad to say they weren't playing D because they were giving up a lot of points, because on a per possession basis, they gave up less points. They were more efficient defensively. Blah, 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 blah. Anyhow.
Yeah.
So it basically just helped us get a better understanding of who was really playing good or bad defense,
or offense,
because the number of points really wasn't telling us anything.
So do you think I mean, just going back to it, so we got this idea of true pace, which is the actual number. Oh, I was just wondering if you could explain your idea versus this concept of possessions as we know it.
The first step, obviously, is to get a handle of these possessions. So currently, with the offensive defensive efficiency ratings, points per possessions, that denominator, the number of possessions, that's calculated. You threw out that the formula for EFG, and you know that's basically a per possession stat also. There's a problem with that for me because.
And just to clarify real quick, when you're talking about the stat, you're talking about the stat that's called pace. And when we talk about when teams play fast or slow, usually what a basketball writer or a blogger or a podcaster is talking about is their possessions per game.
Yes, exactly. Right? So.
And that's what you don't like. You don't think that's actually a good way to measure pace, or the best way to measure pace.
No, we'll get to that in just one second. I want to get back to a little thing real quick.
We certainly will.
So that formula, you know, it takes into account your shots, your 3-point shots, and then also your free throws. And your free throws are multiplied by 0.44, this 0.44 number. This number is basically kind of a kludge to account for times when guys get and ones or shoot technical free throws. When they're not shooting just 2 free throws per foul, basically. So that number is applied to everybody, regardless if a guy took 1 free throw or 10.
Yeah.
And so what that leads to is a slight biasing of the number of possessions. That is not, so it's not a count of the actual possessions in the game. Right?
Right.
So that's one of the things that I do in my database, which I think is the biggest deal, is that it actually counts the possessions. So instead of having this number that's close to the number of possessions, we have a number now that is the number of possessions. So it's a small difference, but I am, you know.
Does anybody else have this? Is anybody else working with this?
Yeah, I mean, people are. It's hard to tell, you know. I think people are kind of cagey with what data they have. They publish the results.
Yeah, right.
So.
Not here. We're all about open sourcing, baby.
Well, I'm not sharing this with you guys.
I already did. It's too late, and I already sold it to Daryl Morin.
You already got your job.
You gave me 100 yeah.
Size triple extra large. So, you know, put it for me, you know, it's kind of a big deal to have the actual count of possessions because I didn't build a laboratory to run a formula on the box score. I wanted to know the real shit. As they say, I apologize for my language.
We didn't put all this work into getting you that underground bunker just so we could come up with bogus results.
So you guys talked about this true pace. You jumped the gun a little bit, but now we can get into it.
All right. I for one like to apologize on behalf of Chris for jumping the gun.
So there's this pace statistic. Which is using the same formula we just talked about, that 0.44 with the free throws and turnovers and so forth, is generally used to talk about the speed of the game. But what that really is an estimation of the number of possessions in a game. It doesn't actually tell you the speed of the game. So in the pace calculation, it takes into account, number of shots taken, obviously. And then you subtract the number of offensive boards, you add in the turnovers, and then you use that free throw formula, and that gets you the pace. So I have a small problem with this personally, because
what's your problem with that as a definition of pace,
it requires that within the context of one game that both teams, it basically says both teams in this game played at the same pace, which is, if you watch basketball, obviously, I don't, but I've heard of it, you know that's just not true. Some teams play fast, some teams play slow, sometimes those teams play against each other, and the teams continue to play fast or slow, or however they like to play.
But over the course of a season, the pace stat still roughly measures the pace at which
absolutely.
Teams play. Just too rough for your
life. That's the real number. I love the real number.
All right, so you think you've come up with something that's closer to the real number, and how did you do that?
So, you know, using the power of information technology. It delved in the database, and it basically came up with a number that is the average number of seconds remaining on the shot clock when a team takes their first shot in a possession, when there's not been interrupted by a timeout, a foul, or all the types of various things that can interrupt the possession and change the speed at which the game is played. There's a few...
This interlude has been brought to you by the Teardrop Runners Legal Department.
There is a very small hole in this calculation in that the play-by-play data does not include when there's a kicked ball or the ball is deflected out of bounds but stays with the offense. But I think those are relatively uncommon. It shouldn't really change the numbers yet that much. And the other thing I did is to exclude any possession that starts, and this is a subject to debate, really, that starts with less than 14 seconds left on the game clock for that quarter.
I'll tell you what, that is a subject for another time. That's a subject for another time. Why don't we get into this actual true pace stat? Because we've been going for a while. I think there's some interesting stuff here. Menzel, walk us through some of the kind of differences that you found when you went through true pace and what you think it can be used for.
One of the things that I found is that this true pace is what we call it. I think it needs a better name, but we'll stick with that for the moment. Is that it is...
Pedantic.
What's going on over there?
Sorry.
It's similar to the overall pace numbers that are published year over year. I think the correlation number is around like 0.7,
right,
which is pretty strong.
Okay.
But it is different enough that we're not really quite measuring the same thing. It opens up the door to do some little more in-depth analysis to look at the effect of individual players on the speed of a team's going on.
Can you just walk us through a little bit some of the more interesting facets of the true pace stat as it's applied? As you look at some of the teams, what stands out to you here?
Yeah, one is the number one team in terms of pace this year, true pace, and they're actually pretty extreme outlier, is Dallas. And they are, I looked up this number previously, looking back a few seasons. As it turns out, no team is really getting into that 7 seconds or less mentality. That might not even exist. So the fastest teams right now are getting a shot off in between 12 and 13 seconds. That's like the upper echelon.
All right, so Manziel, I got a question. Oh, let me go first. I got a question for you, Manziel. If you were John Hollinger and you just got hired by the Dallas Mavericks, how would you use this true pace to analyze, you know, how you would run the team and what kind of players you would want on your team?
Okay. Here's what I would want to look at. One is the effect of true pace on the defense. Do teams just inherently score better at particular paces? They score a little bit better when they play faster. They score better when they play slower. Two, I'd want to know what the effects of varying the pace within a game. So you might have a starting unit with a Steve Nash on it where, you know, you could say that when Steve Nash is in the game, your team is going to play 10% faster and you're going to score better. But when you have the backup in the game, would actually be more ideal to pair him with guys that play with a different pace and, you know, the interaction of the guys that play at different speeds. That'd be the first thing I really wanted to know.
It's an interesting study, and if you can answer this question, this is amazing. But I mean, the thing that I find, you know, that may not work with this theory is that basically I'm not sure that one team can actually use pace to take advantage of the other. So by that I mean that, you know, the defense, the other team can substitute freely. So if one team decides to run a lot, the other team, a strategy they can employ is simply substitute their backups a little bit more.
That's not really exactly true,
and
though. You can only substitute on a dead ball.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, like, if the concept is that you're running at a high pace and you're, like, attriting the other team, or that one team is well-conditioned while the other team is not well-conditioned and you're going to try and exploit that to win, if it's a conditioning issue, simply substituting backups that are presumably fresh and well-rested for players that are starters but are fatigued may allow you to basically kind of null out basically the advantage that the well-conditioned team may have. I don't know. That's just a thought. But.
So Menzel, so what do you see as the primary uses for this then? I mean, as you're going forward, what's the best case scenario for how this could be used to analyze or predict?
That is actually one other thing. Is I wanted to know what teams are the best at dictating the actual tempo of play. So you know, in the Sun 7 seconds era, you know, there was that theory that when they played fast, the other team, even if they were a slow team like the Trailblazers, who that same era were like unbelievably slow paced team. They'd run the straight up ISO for Brand Roy or ISO for Aldridge every single time. That somehow that their running can make the other team change what they want to do. So what teams are better at dictating the pace? And there's also the things where, you know, because if you add in lineup data with this pace idea, the true pace idea, you can figure out what players impact pace the most. I mean, we think it's going to be point guards, obviously, but, you know, that might not be true. We might be able to identify guys who play really well non-point guards at a high pace. And so, you know.
It's really, I mean, in my opinion, pace isn't dependent on a player. On a team or a coach. Players. It's really dependent on sort of offensive and defensive schemes that teams employ. So, for example, pace is really dependent on the number of fast break opportunities a team can generate.
And that's obviously
generated by scheme, not
and defensive
individual
scheme more than anything else too. I mean that's a transition scoring is largely defensive issue.
Yeah, but also an offensive rebounding issue. So how many guys do teams send? Anyway,
these are all interesting variables that we can look at.
We can talk about this later.
I mean, to
these
me, that's still an open question. I have vivid memories of the Sonics fast breaking off a made basket in the early 90s under George Karl. You know.
Yeah, no, there are still plenty of teams that do that.
You know, yeah, I mean, this we can look into it, but anyway,
all right, guys, well, let's, there are obviously a lot of useful things we can talk about here. We have opened up a very interesting topic, and I think we're going to be cracking Manziel's database a lot going forward. I'm excited about it. In the meantime, let's talk about our homework for next week. Manziel is, as we said, morally opposed to watching basketball because he thinks competition is immoral, but the rest of us are going to pick a player to watch this week and talk about their stats next week on the show. Guys, I'm tired of watching a bad team. I'm tired of watching Sacramento.
Yo, you did this to yourself.
I'm not going to spoil myself.
Can we assign a guy to you then? Can I ask you about a guy that...
You know what, yeah, Menzel.
I want to know, I think we talked about him maybe a few weeks ago, Nando DeColo.
Not interested. No, not interested. Thank you, though. I appreciate it.
That guy.
Yeah. Well, look, I wouldn't go so far as to say I hate him, but I want to watch somebody I'm excited about. So I actually chose Jeff Teague, partially because of Atlanta's schedule this week. I like watching Atlanta play, and they're playing Cleveland this week. They're playing Utah this week. They're playing Chicago this week, and they're playing the Wizards this week. Who knows? Maybe I'll get lucky.
So you're still watching a lot of bad teams. Nothing's changed.
I'm watching a lot of everything, Manziel. I try to keep it all upstairs, baby. Chris, you give any thought to who you want to scout?
No, I'm going to let Manziel.
Chris, give me at least a little bit of a criteria.
Don't pick Nando DeColo.
Kind of like maybe a second-year guy.
I'm going to go ahead and sub out a second-year guy for a first-year guy for you. Alexi Shved.
Okay.
Alexi Shved, Menzel, I swear to God, that's exactly what I was thinking. I love it.
All right.
We were just talking about Alexi Shved the other night when we were watching the Timberwolves collapse in yet another game, so that'll be a fun one. Big Shot, you've been quiet because you understand that we're three hours that are just going to shout you down.
I'm gonna find somebody from the New York Knickerbockers. They've lost a few games recently, and I hope they continue. But one player who I think is maybe he's getting enough credit, but I think he's still one of the best players in the league, and that's a little strong. I'm going to Tyson Chandler. They got Indiana and Chicago in the next two games. So they got Indiana, I think, tomorrow, or two nights. And I think Indiana beat the Heat tonight, so it'll be interesting. I'm gonna watch Tyson Chandler.
Alright, cool. You'll get to see a matchup against, Anthony.
No, I will be in Atlanta at the Seahawks Falcons divisional round playoff game. On the 20-yard line. Sitting on the 20-yard line, 18 rows back. Behind the Seahawks bench.
That's so awesome.
Every day I'm wrestling.
It's proof that sometimes good things do happen to good people.
Yeah.
All right, every day we're wrestling. All right, guys. Well, another great show. Good night. Rob's going to sing us out, but until next time, save us a seat at the next Sonics game. Chris, you want to say good night?
Every day we're wrestling. I like that. Every day we're wrestling. Good night, guys.
Good night.
Rob, you going to sing us out?
Yeah, since we haven't done a podcast since Christmas, I thought I would do one Christmas-related, so I'm going to take the tune of Silent Night tonight.
Kemba Walker is a baller, dropping dimes and crossovers. Sometimes he plays like a badass dude. Sometimes he plays with an attitude. But he's on the Bobcats. Sucks that he's on the Bobcats. Darren Williams. Shooting poor in all the gyms. Maybe 'cause he's a natty fatty. Maybe 'cause he's a natty fatty. We'll see if he likes PJ. I guess the answer would be nay. Tosh Gibson. He is tall, average at fall. Kid should give him some more minutes. Pressure off Noah sounds legit. We all miss our boy D-Rose. Looks like Meta just punched somebody in the nose. Playing at home, you win some games. Yelling players' names can be the raucous roar of the crowd. At the refs, they will yell real loud. What can we do with true pace? Just go and ask Mandel's face.